greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the war on gold when we come back. In 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, and Federal Reserve notes. Well, in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that of clad coin or currency. And that is very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries, but out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and our politicians take our gold and silver away from us for no good reason either. And that's because they knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they must first take away the people's gold and silver coin in order to destroy the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and our property rights, because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. And this is in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. And best of all, it's free. And you can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. The war on gold. Well, what is this war on gold? How long has it been going on? The answer is, it's been going on in the modern era since 1922. So the war on gold began in Genoa, Italy, by the elitists, the international bankers, at a meeting that they conducted in Genoa in 1922. Here in the United States, they took our gold away in 1933. They restored gold back in 1976, and then we have been using gold, or at least it's been legal to buy, until Congress enacted the Tax Reform Act of 1986, we now here in the United States have our gold and silver coin back. Isn't that just real special? But why the war on gold? And oftentimes people will ask me, why is it that gold hasn't gone beyond $600 an ounce? And how is it that the government manipulates these markets, and especially the gold and the silver markets, to depress the prices of gold and silver? And what do they care about it anyway, and why do they do that? Well, Anthony Sutton, in his book, written back in 1976 or published in 76, is called The War on Gold. And there's a little country called South Africa. And this little country of South Africa produces about 80% of the gold, that is the new gold, produced in the world every year. South Africa is a pretty important piece of real estate, pretty valuable piece of real estate. And the Marxists, the communists, took it over. And then they drove out the white government down there, and they installed a Marxist dictatorship, a communist dictatorship, in South Africa. Now, of course, they call that a democracy down there. Okay, so then we have a democratic dictatorship. That's what we have here in the United States, democratic. That means that you can pick your dictator once every 4 years, but the policies contain the exact same policy of the last administration. You don't see a dime's worth of difference between Democrats and Republicans, and the same is true in South Africa. But some very important geopolitical restructuring has occurred in South Africa over the past 30 years, between 1976 and 2006, which is covered here prophetically in 1976 by Anthony Sutton. Let's take a look at this. Gold is dead, isn't it? Well, those who do not accept gold as the basis of the world's currency system may well be persuaded that it should be retained as an alternative. If the present attempt to run the world system on floating paper currency fails, then I can see no reason to expect it to succeed. Then the gold alternative will be needed. At the moment, it is vitally important that the gold alternative should be preserved, even if that gold alternative cannot yet be restored. Historically, wars on gold have been associated with tyranny and totalitarian grabs for political power. When gold coins circulate freely alongside paper money, as occurred with the Continental Bill and the greenback in the United States and the British paper pound of 1797, gold will be valued more than paper money. Following this inexorable law of the marketplace, the paper currency will be placed at a discount. But when a political power base is threatened by these superior competitive characteristics of gold, too often the paper currency or debt is declared as the only legal tender to the exclusion of gold, such as the cases of Kublai Khan or John Law's Bank Royal and the Federal Reserve Note Dollar. But sooner or later, in the war on gold, physical coercion has to be used to impose such a politicized fiat money on an unwilling citizenry. Our contemporary war on gold began internally with the establishment of the Federal Reserve System in 1913 and then externally with the Genoa Conference of 1922, which introduced the gold exchange standard. Coercive aspects were introduced internally in 1934 when President Franklin D. Roosevelt confiscated American gold. This coercive character was confirmed internationally in 1971 when President Richard Nixon suspended convertibility of the dollar into gold. The legalization of gold in the United States in 1975 was probably not a withdrawal from coercion, but rather an interim effort to make the propaganda war on gold more credible. History suggests that gold will once again be made illegal in the United States and subject to arbitrary seizure by a police state apparatus. Looking back over monetary history, we see that gold has always been prominent as a protector of individual sovereignty. Private gold ownership is inconsistent with the aims of dictatorship. A war on gold is a necessary concomitant to centralized political power. Wars and fiat currencies have always gone hand in hand. From the 800-year-old Byzantine Empire, which traded from one end of the known world to the other, to the industrialized and the industrialization of 19th century Europe and the United States, we see that economic prosperity was based on gold and gold-stabilized monetary systems. Significantly, throughout history, those eras of gold-backed currency, which brought stability, became platforms for sustained economic advances. Those were eras of relative peace and prosperity. France was on the gold standard for 100 years from 1814 to 1914, Switzerland for 86 years from 1850 to 1936. Other European countries based their industrial progress on the monetary stability of the gold standard. Far from being restrictive and denying liquidity, as our modern internationalists have claimed, the gold standard is a stable framework, within which a free civilization can advance. Perhaps not with spectacular, something for everyone, welfare programs, but certainly with solid, respectable growth that does not collapse into inflationary, deflationary spirals, or slumpflation, or stagflation, as they describe it in England and the United States. What, then, is the rationale behind the contemporary war on gold today? Well, in the final analysis, the current and continuing war on gold is a political power play of almost incredible proportions. To ignore the political aims of the paper fanatics by looking only at the monetary aspects is to ignore the full breadth and scope of the modern drive towards what has been called a New World Order. The discipline of gold has always restricted political schemers, whether they be John Law, John Maynard Keynes, or today's Wall Street internationalists. Money is power. Gold is a universal and timeless money, which has been unexcelled as a store of value, usually available only to those who will yield scarce resources to gain it. Paper money and debt money, by contrast, can be easily created. With such a fiat paper money currency, power can be created by whomsoever has the legal monopoly of the creation process. Whoever it is that owns the paper factory controls the system. Paper money or debt creation is flexible, infinitely expandable. It is precisely this ersatz quality of paper and debt money that makes it politically useful and so politically desirable to the power brokers. That is because it can be manipulated. Gold cannot be manipulated. It cannot be manipulated politically. Therefore, it is unusable and it is totally undesirable for political ends. When the supply of this ersatz money is inflated by an increase of bank credit, printing bank notes, or creating IMF special drawing rights, one does not increase the amount of goods and services available in the marketplace. The result, therefore, is price inflation. More money is available to purchase the same amount of goods. As the artificial fiat money works its way into the economic system, more paper claims are demanded per unit of goods. Thus, it bids up the prices, and this bidding up of prices is unavoidable and has always led to depreciation of the paper money. The inevitable end of the road occurs when the paper has zero value. The German 1923 and the German 1946 mark, along with the Hungarian pengo and Greek drachma, are just a few of the several hundred examples where countries have left the gold standard and then embarked upon a paper money excursion, only to see their economy crash as their currencies ended up as being worthless. This, in turn, causes a great turnover of property to new owners. Now, of course, gold can and gold has led to price inflation. But gold is very limited in its supply by natural forces, and it requires scarce resources to produce. Therefore, gold has nowhere near the same ability to generate price increases as do paper debt systems. Now today, a gigantic multi-trillion dollar pyramid of illiquid paper debt is poised precariously on a small tip of liquid, tangible gold. And everybody's paper fiat money and credit line is someone else's debt. And the United States Treasury, so it claims, is going to dispose of the liquid gold tip of the pyramid. The objective is to abolish gold. So in any war on gold, two factors always emerge to entice holders of paper money and this illiquid debt to substitute gold or other tangible assets for their fantasy fiat holdings. Price increases encourage a search for a reliable store of wealth. Traditionally, gold has been that store of wealth of last resort. Then, institutional failures encourage a search for safe investments as the owners of paper wealth become more concerned with the security of liquid assets than with producing more paper profits. Gold produces no income. Gold is a sterile way to hold wealth. But gold protects both liquidity and value in storage. Well, during the past few years in the contemporary war on gold, there have been price upswings touching 35% per year in both Europe and 10% in the United States. The depression of 1974-75 generated cracks in the illiquid debt structure, most obviously in real estate and banking. In the years ahead, subsequent boom and depression cycles will have even greater amplitude, with double-digit price increases, including double-digit interest rates, followed by the complete collapse of some sectors of the debt pyramid. Well, let me put a bracket around that paragraph right there, because that's what happened. By the end of the 1970s, we had a 21% interest rate. And we had a collapse in the housing market. In 1979, I could have bought every house in Boise for no money down. Now, we're seeing that very same scenario that we saw in the 1970s duplicate itself now in 2006, going into 2007, 8, and 9. Now, whether or not we will be able, Treasury officials and the Wall Street bankers be able to pull the fat out of the fire a second time like they did in the 1970s is yet to be seen. And of course, we're all sitting here on the sidelines cheering on Ben Bernanke, hoping against hope that he will, in the end, be able to pull the fat out of the fire one more time. But even if you can do it one more time in 2007 or 8, you're still faced with the next time and the next time and the next time. And every time that this economy, the world's economy, this debt fiat currency is pulled back from the cliff, every time that's done, it reminds me of the story of the gunslinger who has 17 notches on his gun. And he goes out, and then there's always an 18th guy that wants to challenge him, and then a 19th, and a 20th, and a 21st, and a 22nd, which inevitably means that at some point in time, the gunslinger is going to meet somebody who's just a split second faster than he is, and then he will be dead with his 17, 18, or 19 notches. And then the new gunslinger goes out, and he's got one notch on his gun. And then 2, 5, 9, 11, and 15, until somebody comes along and knocks him off. Now, historically, these paper fiat currencies have been recurring in empires, nations, city-states, over the past 4 or 5,000 years with regularity. Hitler did it. Charlemagne did it. Kublai Khan did it. We Americans are doing it. The British have done it. more than once, and so have we, and they've always failed. What makes us think that it's going to succeed this time? Now, here's the tragedy of the failure of the economy. You lose everything that you've got that isn't bought and paid for, and the things that are bought and paid for can be taken away from you to satisfy the debts of those things that aren't paid for. So the small minority of people who own everything that they possess, free and clear, are the only people that get away, get out of, or succeed, or live through these economic catastrophes or these economic collapses. Just take a look at your own financial circumstance today. Have you got a mortgage on your house, your car, your furniture, and everything else? If you've got one or two of these items free and clear, then picture this. When the economy explodes, or implodes, as they call it, and we go into, like the Argentines did just here two or three years ago, their peso is no good, they go on to COD, and all of a sudden their standard of living drops by about half. Because now they can only import half as much as they did before, and they have to pay for everything cash on delivery. In America, here's what that'll mean. We import $800 billion a year and export $200 billion. All of a sudden, we will be able to buy $200 billion a year because that's what we export. And the other $600 billion that we are now used to living, you know, it's a standard of living that we're now used to, will be taken away from us suddenly, overnight. This brings chaos in the marketplace, chaos in the banking system, so they close the banks. Now, you can't get your money out of the bank for 6 or 8 weeks. You can't put money in. You can't write checks. You can't meet your payroll. You can't buy anything because you haven't got any money with which to buy the raw materials. Your factories have to close. Unemployment goes up in Argentina was 62% at the peak. Now, picture America. The banks are closed for 6 weeks to 3 months. Unemployment goes to 60%. Do you think that that is going to be a neat period of time? And then comes the inevitable foreclosures. You're out of a job, you can't make your payments on your house, and so your house is foreclosed. Can't make your payments on your car, so they take your car. Can't make your payments on the furniture, so they take the furniture. Now you're homeless without furniture and no transportation. This is a massive transfer of wealth from one party to another. That's the inevitable conclusion of these economic collapses. They don't last forever. The Argentine economy today is growing at around 8% a year. They're doing nicely. You know, once they got off of the credit and the dole, and they got to going to work and making products and living within their means, all of a sudden now things are starting to look up for them. But it doesn't discount the fact that they lost everything that they had and they're now in the process of rebuilding it. When you're 70 or 80 years old and you lose everything you've got, it's hard to go out and get a job and go rebuild it, isn't it? Now, for individuals, hyperinflation and the collapse of some sectors will breed a new attitude, and there will be a mad scramble for gold and other tangible wealth, like wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. Holders of paper money will follow Tom Paine's injunction of 200 years ago. The question for the people to ask, and the only question is this, whether the quantity of banknotes payable on demand, which the bank has issued, be greater than the bank can pay off in gold and silver. And the answer in this country, boys and girls, is there isn't enough gold and silver to pay off the banknotes. They're not even redeemable in gold and silver. So as we look into the future in competition with the professional prognosticators, the domestic war on gold looks like this. There will be an increasing realization by the public that the ratio between paper debt and gold is inexorably shifting in favor of gold, that public confidence is the all-important requirement to keep a paper debt money system afloat, and this confidence is eroding. scourges and surges in confidence erosion will account for short-run increases in the price of gold, while for intermittent periods the government will regain some public confidence. When this occurs, gold will settle back to its approximate long-run ratio to paper debt units. Now, at some point, however, there is a distinct possibility of panic. If debt holders see the debt pyramid collapsing or even anticipate its collapse, particularly, this will be true if there is a general realization that paper assets are actually someone else's debt and are therefore inherently valueless or worthless. However, it's important to note a distinction between realization and action. Investors may know that the pyramid is illiquid and in danger of collapse. These same investors may act or they may not act on this knowledge. The herd instinct suggests that only a very few will bail out in time. The majority will act in panic after it is far too late. Any panic-induced scramble for tangible assets, of which gold is the historical leader, could eat up the IMF's 100 million ounces of gold and all of the gold in Fort Knox in a few weeks, if not just a few days. And it's highly significant that in the gold pool scramble, the private offtake of gold equaled 2,500 tons in 2 years. And in 1967, the dash for gold, the average investor was not even in the race. The upside potential for gold prices in a panic environment is awe-inspiring, precisely because of the gigantic size of the debt pyramid. Any figures become meaningless. How many assignats or 1923 German marks or Hungarian pengos does it take today to buy 1 ounce of gold? I might point out at this juncture of time that gold in this period from 1971, when Nixon took the gold payments of Bretton Woods out of the equation, until 1980, which was just 9 years, gold went from $35 to $850. So take $850, divide that by 35, and that takes us 24 times. 2,400% increase in 9 years. Pretty significant. Now today the price of gold in May inched up to $732 and the government stepped in with the plunge protection team to drive the price down to maintain stability. They're bouncing or they're juggling a lot of balls. They're keeping the real estate market from collapsing, the stock market. They're suppressing the gold and silver market. They're managing two wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. They're preparing for a third war in Iran, probably a military coup of some type in Venezuela. And then you've got the domestic problems of the United States economy, the balance of payments deficit, and the national debt. And all of these balls have to be juggled constantly to keep this pyramid, this debt pyramid, functioning and operating worldwide. That's quite a chore for Ben Bernanke and the gang. And so those of us sitting on the sidelines are sitting here saying, well, at some point in time, one of these balls is going to get missed, and it's going to fall to the floor. And that's going to trigger a panic, a sell-off, a change. And when that occurs, there's going to be hell to pay. That's the way it was in 1783. That's the way it was in 1929. And I suspect that that's the way it's going to be the next time, in whatever year that happens to work out to be. A downside support to the price of gold stems from the unwillingness of European central banks to see their reserve and their assets decline in value, even in the short run. There is an increasing realization by the investing public and institutions that central banks do indeed have a stake in gold. and the basics of the problem must always be held in mind, and the basics derive from a distillation of historical experience, not the self-promoting meanderings of contemporary academic economists or the power objectives of the New World Order imperialists. Did you catch that? There is an increasing realization by the investing public and institutions that central banks do indeed have a stake in gold. In fact, boys and girls, it's a major stake. Did you know that the price of oil and gold move in tandem, and that the price of oil and gold is manipulated, has been since 1971, and that oil is now the backing for our economy? And here's the way that game is being played. And the reason that gold has to be manipulated and kept low is so that the physical gold available can be bought at this low price of $700 or $600 or $550 an ounce by the Arabs. Our agreement is that we will keep the price of gold low if they will keep the price of oil low. And that's because when they want to convert the oil to gold, they produce the oil, we consume the oil, and we pay them in gold. But first of all, we pay them in worthless paper. Then they take the worthless paper to the London Metal Exchange and convert it to gold. Most of this gold is actually held in the form of paper demands on gold. 82% of all of the gold traded in the world is traded by one paper contract to another paper contract. Only 18% of the world's gold supply is actually transacted in physicals. So it's easy enough for the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve to come into the marketplace and offer to sell gold, and indeed they sell it. They sell millions of ounces and tons of gold on paper contracts for future delivery, next month or next year. So watch how easy it is to manipulate the price of gold down. The Federal Reserve simply offers gold for sale in the world market, the London Metal Exchange, for $550 an ounce. And whammo presto, what's the price of gold today? $550 an ounce. In legal theory, the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve could work the price of gold down to 35 cents an ounce if they wanted to. All they got to do is offer it for sale for 35 cents. And who in the hell is going to buy it from me for $600 an ounce when the Fed is over here selling gold paper for 35 cents? Now here's where the rubber is going to meet the road, children. There's only so much physical gold out there. And right now, there are enough paper demands held by the Arabs and Chinese and Russians and everybody else in the world, enough paper contracts, that it would take 2,500 tons of world production per year for 15 years to pay them all off. So when you hear about Germany's central bank selling 10 tons of gold, they're not selling 10 tons of gold. They're selling 10 tons worth of gold contracts. Is there 10 tons of gold in the Bundesbank? You bet, there is. But they've been selling that same 10 tons of gold about 55 times over. At least 15 times over. Now, one of these days, when you people out there start saying, well, okay, just send me a few ounces of that. And when enough people do that, you'll find out there isn't enough physical gold out there to satisfy all those demands. That's the Achilles heel of the world's gold system. The silver isn't any better off. It's also been sold 15 years into the future. So if you're going to get into gold and silver, make sure that you take physical delivery of the product, because all you people that are sitting there with pieces of paper in the final analysis, and when the fat lady sings, that's what you're going to have, is pieces of paper. Meanwhile, we have to remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law, 8 schools in all, from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, 7 days a week. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. And these sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite or use here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you do hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. And for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, we are reviewing an old-timey book called The War on Gold, written by Anthony Sutton back in 1970, 4 or 5, published in 1976. It's as up-to-date today as if it were written last week, and I pointed that out to you in a number of examples so far in the last 2 or 3 programs, and I'll continue to do that as we go through this book. If you'd like to get a copy of it, you'll probably have to get it from a used bookstore. And there's a neat way to do that. These used bookstores are tied into the Internet. And here's what I do. You go into the used bookstore and you say, hey, I'm looking for this book called The War on Gold by Anthony Sutton, published in 1976 or 77. They plug that into the computer. And then they look around and there's about 500,000 used bookstores around the world that are tied in to this system. And one of those 500,000 bookstores is going to have a copy or two of this book, this obscure, unpopular book. This book is about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party. And I don't think it was any more popular back in 1976. Because, see, most people are into paper money. And when you mention gold, they look at you, roll their eyes, and they're like, oh, this fool is suffering from the terminal stupids. So, I don't want to wake anybody up, and I'm not trying to free the slaves. I mentioned that to you last time, that I'm all in favor of slavery. Hell, I'm all in favor of the income tax. And that's because if you free all these slaves, it raises the question of who in the hell's going to do the work. I don't want to do it. I'm perfectly satisfied to have slaves working their hearts out, paying their income tax, paying their social security, pumping up and keeping the paper money system alive, while I use property and tangible assets to make real profit and gain in property off the backs of the hard-working people who roll their eyes and laugh at me and call me stupid. I'm not disappointed. I'm not trying to wake any of you people up. Keep after it. But occasionally you run across somebody that writes a letter and they say, my God, I can't figure out how in the world the government or whoever it is that's doing it, the Wall Street bankers, can manipulate the gold and the silver market. And I pointed that out. It's very easy. No big deal. It requires an entity that has control of the printing press and can make money. So what they do is they go out here and they want to show you people that the price of gold is going down. And indeed it is. And they come along and they say, well, we will sell 10 tons of gold on the open market for $575 an ounce. And now, if you can buy gold for $575, you're not going to pay George Gordon $600 or $625 or $7.25, are you? So you'll go out. Now, they're not actually selling you any physical gold. I mean, they're not. If you think that when the Bundesbank sells 10 tons of gold or the Federal Reserve sells 5 tons of gold, that they're physically going in there and taking gold bricks out and putting them on the auction block, you people don't have a sense of perspective and reality. That isn't the way that's done. It is true that the buyers come into the marketplace and they buy that 10 tons of gold. But they don't take physical delivery of 10 tons of gold. That gold sits right there where it's always sat, drawing dust, just like it always has. And they sell pieces of paper that say you've got a claim on this pile of gold. The problem with that is that you've got the same 10 tons of gold that's been sold 15 times. You got 15 pieces of paper out there that say, you owe me 10 tons of gold. Now, boys and girls, if any one of those guys ever walks over there and draws out his 10 tons, the other 14 of you people out there don't have 10 tons that you can draw from. Now, do you? And 82% of all the gold that's traded in the world is traded on the London Metal Exchange. It's all done in paper. $10 billion a day in paper gold is traded on the London Bullion Exchange. I forgot the letters they use now. The London. That's the London Metal Exchange. London is four letters. London something Metal Exchange. And that's what they're doing every day. Gold is tied to oil. And the deal that we made with the Arabs back in the 1970s was that we will work to keep the price of gold down so that the 18% that is being bought, sold, and traded, that is, you know, the world produces about 2,500 tons of gold a year. 2,500 tons, 2,500 tons per year. But the gold, the usage of gold or the sales of gold is about 3,700 tons a year. 1,200 tons more. About 50% more than is being produced. Well, you know, you don't have to be real smart with letters after your name, you know, to figure out that you can't produce 2,500 somethings and sell 3,700 of them. So what you have to do is you have to sell pieces of paper which says you got a claim check. And then everybody in the world's running around selling and buying and selling and trading all these claim checks based upon the price of gold that goes up and down. And then there's two metal markets out there. One is paper and the other one is physical. I'm in what we call the physicals market. If I buy an ounce of gold, I take physical delivery of it. Most people, when they buy an ounce of gold, they don't see the gold. They don't have the gold. It's in somebody's warehouse. It's in the Comex warehouse or somebody else's. And then those warehouses sell that gold a time or two or three. We don't know how many times the amount of gold there is in paper that is circulating out there. I don't know if it's 15 times or 30 times or 45 or 60 or 110 times. We know it's 15 times. That's what everybody admits to. That's what everybody knows. But it's worse than that. It's more than that. But we don't know how much worse. We don't know how much more than 15 times. Now, that's been going on for a long time, and Anthony Sutton told us that back in 1976. He's got more to say, though. He says the basic question that we should hold in mind is, what is money? The answer to that is, money is whatever people think it is. Some people think it's a euro, some people think it's a Swiss franc, and some think it's a Canadian dollar. Whatever the hell you people think it is, that's what it is. Money is a commodity that people agree to mutually and voluntarily to use in exchange for goods and services. And money is something that possesses a store of value. Money must be credible, and it must be believable. If its worth is a fiction, it must be a credible fiction. A government can decree what can be used as legal tender. It cannot arbitrarily decree what will be accepted as money. There are dozens of historical examples that confirm this basic lesson. Let me give you an example here. Here at the law school, tuition is paid in gold coin. Gold coin. That's acceptable money. When you walk in here with a check or a money order or Federal Reserve notes or euros or scudos or Swiss francs or Canadian dollars, I look at you and say, geez, that's nice, but I don't want that. And sometimes people say, my God, this is money. I don't doubt it, but it's not good money. I don't want it. I had a guy in here tell me one time, says, you know, you're a fool. You're not taking this money. I said, well, that's all right. I'm probably a fool, but I'm not taking that money. No, you want to offer me Confederate dollars? You want to offer me Continental dollars? You want to offer me German marks? I mean, come on, kid. I want to get paid. Paid, P-A-I-D. I want to get paid in gold coin. Now, people in the process of exchange with each other use as money that which they prefer. I'll go along with that. Some people prefer Canadian dollars. Some people prefer euros and the scudos and Russian rubles. Some people prefer American dollars. That commodity which best fulfills the need for money, not that which a government dictates, however harsh the edict may be. Now, there have been times here in America when our government has said that anybody that refuses to accept the money of the United States is a traitor to his country. It's coming again. Our government, when this thing turns turtle, will say, well, if you don't take this money, we're going to punish you. We'll lock you up in prison. They've done it before, and they've done it again. Tyranny, kids, comes from unjust weights and balances. The opposite to that is gold and silver. Who was it that thunk up gold and silver? It was none other than God Almighty Himself. And He told us, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And there's no profit, and there's no political motivation or manipulation involved with gold and silver. It brings about peace and stability. It brings about prosperity and peace. And fiat currencies produce war and friction and strife and loss. It always has, does now, and always will. Now, people prefer the military or the military-industrial complex and fiat currency and bad health and sickness and disease as the basis, the underpinning of their economy worldwide. Hey, listen, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. However, I don't want to participate. I don't want cancer, and I don't want to participate in the cancer program. I don't want to participate in war. I don't want to participate in income tax. I don't want to participate in retirement. I don't want to participate in Social Security. But I don't want to get in the way. I don't want to interfere with the happiness and success of the millions of people who want to do all of the above. Fortunately, under our Constitution, we have a system whereby those that want to participate in cancer, cancer therapy, disease, and sickness have every right to do that. And those of us that want to participate in the opposite, which is good health, no insurance, no Social Security, can't say no death because we all die, but, you know, I don't want to die from cancer. You know, then we can make that other choice. If you don't want to participate in income tax, there's a choice to be made. And that's called gold and silver and just weights and balances. Now, if you want to participate in unjust weights and balances, then you have to participate in Social Security and income tax. And there's 14 of these taxes, by the way, in this country. And you have to participate in the program. And if that's what you choose, well, then that's your choice. Sutton, on the other hand, says, hey, did you kids know that there are some side effects that come from that? And we've been suffering from these side effects now for a good long time. I agree with Sutton. I think he hit the nail on the head. He hit the nail on the head in 76, and it's just as applicable today. So how did these basic specifications for a desirable money conform with those of SDR? Those are called special drawing rights, or fiat Federal Reserve notes, and debt money in general. The answer is they don't. Special drawing rights are not even paper money. They're computer entries. Electrical impulses fed to the International Monetary Fund computer in Washington, D.C. Special drawing rights can be expanded or contracted by the actions of a computer operator. They are subject both to random and to arbitrary action. In January of 1975, for example, the IMF increased members' borrowing rights by 40% after 10 minutes of discussion, but such borrowing rights have no valid claim on real tangible assets. Now, picture this. The moguls at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, in 1975 said, hey, guess what? We need to expand the money supply by 40%. So presto change-o, they push the buttons and expand the money supply by 40%. But now, when they did that, did they increase the number of gallons of milk in all of the refrigerated coolers by 40%? Did they increase the number of television sets that were completed and finished and manufactured and on the shelf ready to sell by 40%? Did they produce 40% more automobiles, 40% more steel, 40% more airplanes, 40% more tires? No, none of the above. Conversely, when we use gold as a monetary metal, when we go to produce gold, we have to put in a commensurate number of hours of labor to get the gold out of the ground, which computes exactly with the number of hours of labor that somebody had to put in to make a ton of steel, which comports precisely with how many hours that somebody had to put in to make a rubber tire, so that the economy always balances. Now listen, paper money is a wonderful invention. Don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking paper money. I always said, you know, if God made anything better than a pig to eat, he kept it for himself, or a woman, he must have kept that secret. I love women and I love pig. And I love paper money. Don't get me wrong. But the problem that goes along with this paper money is that paper benefits a few at the expense of many. So when we have paper money and we expand it by 40%, boy, the guy that gets that first 40% and goes out into the marketplace and spends it, he's like the guy with $1,000 in his pocket that goes into Walmart and cleans the shelves off. Now, if all of us go into Walmart, there's only 2 cents worth of goods on the shelf for every dollar that we possess. That's how many dollars are out there against the amount of goods that are on the shelf. And so we're all holding these dollars with the expectation that when we want to go to Walmart, there will be shoes and big screen TVs on the shelf. As long as just one or two of us go in to buy them, we're all right. But if everybody does that, we're going to find out that we can only get 2%. So the guy with the first 40% goes out, cleans the shelves off, and the rest of us end up with nothing. Now somebody's going to say, well, but that's good for the stockholders. You know, we go out here and somebody comes up with an idea and they say, well, what we need is fiat currency. And so that fiat currency, it's good for the stockholders at Enron. I saw, not Enron, but Exxon, I saw that they made $10 billion in the third quarter. God, that's wonderful. But to get that $10 billion, they had to charge $3 a gallon for gas. So millions of people, you know, 100 million people went out there and they bought a gallon of gas for $3. And that was $300 million that went into Enron's pocket. And 100 million of it went to the stockholders, and 20 million of it went to the CEOs and all of the big wigs at the top. And that was wonderful for those guys. God bless them. I hope they build another $5 million mansion somewhere in Florida. But meanwhile, back on the farm, you see, there were about 100 million Americans out there that had to work for a half an hour to buy that gallon of gas. And they would have only had to work for 15 minutes for that gas if it would have been selling for a buck and a half. And if we were dealing in gold and silver, we would have jobs for those people digging gold and silver out of the ground instead of somebody having a monopoly for turning out $100 bills. So, you know, again, paper money and inflation is a wonderful invention, and it benefits 100 people at the top at the expense of 10,000 people at the bottom. And as long as you 10,000 people at the bottom want to support those 100 people at the top, keep after it. Get after it. I just decided I didn't want to do that anymore, so I dropped out of the program. And I want to leave everybody else in the program. Anthony Sutton comes along and says, hey, by the way, did you people know how this game is being played? Now, the God of Abraham came up with a little different system. He said, now listen, we're going to have a thing here called just weights and balances. And we're going to spend as much labor, as much time, effort, and energy, as much sweat dripping off your nose, digging gold out of the ground to pay for that oil as there is sweat dripping off your nose, drilling that oil well and getting that oil out of the ground. And the two are going to balance. And we're going to have X number of ounces of gold and X number of barrels of oil. And the traditional number has been about 23 barrels of oil for 1 ounce of gold. And then today it's down around 7 or 8. Now, kids, that ain't just exactly the way it's always been. And I think that if we got back into balance and back into equilibrium, we'd all live better, and we'd all have more, and the guys at the top would have a lot less. And that's bad for the guys at the top. That's bad for the Republicans and Republicans and the Republicrats. That's not good for them. It's not good for political control. It's not good for war. It's not good for defense. I don't deny that. But I think it would be a hell of a lot better for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. All right, I'm about out of time, guys, so I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.